All right, welcome to another edition of Behind the Blog. Today's feature is the one and only Francis Ellis.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Absolutely, brother. So we are here at Stand Up New York. It's on the Upper West Side, 78th in Amsterdam. It's a tiny, it's a comedy club with a lot of character. We said it in an affectionate way. It's got a little grunge to it.
Yeah.
And you said that you would call this place, out of all the places you performed, you would call this place home.
Yeah, well, you know, it's probably the place right now where I perform the most. But at the same time, I guess my home club, I also perform a lot at Gotham, mm-hmm. and I run a show there. So it's, I don't know, it's between those two. But I love this place. They're very good to me, and there's a reason I chose here for us to shoot this.
Yeah. So. One of those spots where you walk in and you're comfortable. You walk in, you know the owner, you grab a drink, you make yourself at home.
Right. They're really good to me here. There's been a lot of beer has been spilled in here. You know, the floor is like a muddled shade of black. and you know, lots of people. I've bombed here. I've had ovations here. So it's usually, you know what you're going to get, and it's a pretty fair crowd. So
it's a cool spot, and it's an interesting life that you lead, and one that is different from everybody else at Barstool. And you give me hope in a way for yourselves. You give me hope because, you know, I'm a Barstool lifer. And at this point, you know, my success is tied into the company's success. And so I've got a vested interest in everybody who comes through the door at this point. And, you know, there's a ton of new talented people for sure. And we're constantly growing, but to watch you come in, do something entirely different from everybody else that's been at Barstool, and watch you go through the ringer, watch you go through some ups and some downs, some doubts, some big moments, some bad moments, and come out the other side, is all just very encouraging for the world of Barstool. Because it's like, it's not cookie cutter. It's not the same stuff. And there were times where it was like, I don't know, is this going to work out? Maybe not. Yeah. And then to see that you are thriving, it just gives me hope that, like, yo, this Barstool thing, finding new people and working them in, it's going to work.
Yeah, I think there were definitely moments where I did not think I was going to make it in terms of I thought I had to quit.
I think there were moments that we thought that about you too.
Yeah, because I was just so bummed out and beaten down, and I couldn't handle, you know, the sort of making fun of people for the drawing to light small things, mm-hmm. that, like, you know, fallibilities and sort of mistakes, and making massive stories out of those. And mm-hmm. I wasn't aware yet that those stories fade almost instantly.
Yep.
I thought it was going to plague me for the rest of my career. I thought I would be known as the creep who DM'd the model, or the guy who faked cancer.
Oh, we'll get into those.
I really thought, like, it's over. This is out on the internet, mm-hmm. and I've only been here a month, and I tried, and now I'm going to have to go back to doing something else.
Well, but it's just, Barstool is just, everything is hyper. Everything is mm-hmm. zoomed in, magnified, and made that much bigger. But it goes that much quicker too. You know, there'll be someone else who fucks up. There'll be someone else. You'll do something else that overshadows that, and it's just on to the next. So for better or worse, it can work to your benefit. It can work against you, but it's going to be quick no matter what.
Yeah. And I think one of the benefits I had coming in was that I actually had been a fan of Barstool for years, mm-hmm. and not like the most ardent stoolie, but I would check in with the site every day for years and years. So I came in knowing, at least thinking, that I knew what the type of humor was, mm-hmm. how to write in the tone of Barstool, thinking I had thought for a long time that I could contribute to the company. But it's one thing to think you can work there and put the content out. It's another thing entirely to weather the storm of working within the office.
Yeah.
You get thrown into a dryer and you come out and you either, like, sit down, puke, and go home crying, or you somehow find your way to stand up and just say, I'm not fazed by that.
I think what it actually is you sit down, you puke, you cry, but you just get, you don't go home. You come back. You go for more.
Right.
And that, I feel like everybody has a moment at Barstool where you hit that crossroads and some people go home, or, I mean, a lot of people are, you know, they'll stick around, but metaphorically they almost go home.
Right.
You know what I mean? You might still be here and get the paycheck, but you hit one of those roadblocks and you either got to power through it or you check out. And I think that you have powered through.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate that. I remember when I came in, a lot of people accused me of having the thinnest skin ever. And I think I definitely did. But another way to say that is that you're just like a sensitive feeling human being.
And that's where, I mean, that's oddly like a rarity at Barstool. Or was a rarity.
Well, I'm not anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sad part.
I know,
like,
I've
sacrificed empathy and vulnerability and what I used to consider positive qualities for this job. And now I've got this hardened shell and I really am not moved much anymore. And it affects me both in my like private life, in my family life.
I know
people
that.
Can't get through to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself like distant and aloof and just kind of, I'd rather exist removed from feeling an emotion because I learned that those were
negative.
Weaknesses.
Those are going to be problems. I know.
Things that we targeted.
I mean, I would love to get to a point where you don't need to do that.
Yeah.
But that is why we are like a cut above and a very large cut above from the rest of the internet. And it comes at a steep price, but I will say that at least there is the return. You know, it's not like we're doing this for nothing.
No.
You are a part. We are all a part of a major, major thing going on. I think when you look back on it, we're all going to be, have been a part of something like super special. And I think like anything else, you know, sports and professional athletic careers and Hollywood careers and shit like that, it comes at a steep, steep price.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right. You look at some people like Dan, I think he's very guarded with his private life and that's one strategy. And then another is kind of, you took the road of being completely open and it's like the two extremes. You can't really live in the middle. And if you are a completely open book, I find that people, Japs is very open too. Mm-hmm. You know, he broadcasts his family on his Instagram and he blogs about his wife having diarrhea and all these things. And like, you know, it's like you have one or the other, but if you exist in the middle where you want to pick and choose what can and can be known,
I can't do that.
That's when it really eats you. And I find Nate struggles with that a lot, you know, because there are certain things like he wants out there and others he doesn't. And I'm at the point now where I'm pretty much light speed, open book, come at me, this is it, you know.
You know, it's like anything else, like that, those things are only going to get to you if you let them get to you.
Yeah.
And it's really about, you know, like, it's kind of the 8 mile Papa Doc be rabid sort of thing where it's like, yeah, I mean, I can admit to all of these things because I now, it's one thing to say you have thick skin and it's another thing to actually have it.
Right.
Because thick skin is not to me like, you know, when people are like, I don't even read the comments. Like, yes, you do.
Right.
Yes, you do. We all do. We all see our feedback. We'll all go on a Reddit page. We all read our mentions and we all want people to like us.
Yeah.
And when they say things and they don't like you, it hurts.
Yeah.
But the thick skin comes into play of whether you let that stop you from doing what you do.
Right.
And whether you actually let that truly affect you. Like you said, you sit down, you cry, and you go home.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I sit down, I puke, I cry, I internalize it. I actually sometimes will listen to it. Maybe they're right. Maybe I could do this. Maybe I could do that. But then you can't let that stop you.
Right.
Otherwise, it's all for nothing.
Yeah. I mean, I find that the feedback for me is like gambling in that you dive into the Reddit or the comments after something you've put out, for me, especially like the Variety Hour, where we put so much work into it.
Months
and you're
months.
So inside the material that you honestly don't know if it's funny anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea how people are going to react.
That's a great point, yeah.
And some of it was good and some of it was bad. And like, I found that the bad feedback hurt way more than the good feedback felt good.
Oh, yeah.
So like in gambling, I always found when I won money, it never felt as good as losing money felt bad.
1,000%.
Which is
agree.
One of the reasons I stopped doing it. I just felt sick when I lost money. And when I won money, I was like, relieved, mm-hmm. not like ecstatic.
Yep. That comparison is so spot on. It's why I don't even gamble at all. It's just like, yeah. the juice is not worth the squeeze.
Here. Right.
And it is funny with the feedback is like, you know, you try to tell yourself, these guys don't know what they're talking about when it's negative. And when it's positive, you're like, oh yeah, fuck
yeah,
when,
I am that when, good, when
it,
right. Yeah, yeah.
If you're going to be honest about it, you shouldn't take any of it into right. account.
Well, I mean, Kevin, to your credit, I don't think anyone has persisted and remained stoic in the face of greater adversity at this company than you. And
yeah, I hope I try. I think I appreciate that.
I mean, it's just a remarkable feat of like steadiness and consistency that you continue to come to work and put out the work you do.
I think it's compartmentalizing is what it is.
Yeah.
And I think that I probably do it to a drastically unhealthy extent. And I think I always kind of did that and I was an accountant and I could do that job over here and do the blogging over here. Mm-hmm. And, when in the early days of blogging, when it really was more of a character, it was like, all right, this is what I really think. This is who I really am. Mm-hmm. But over here, I'm going to say some crazy shit. And then those worlds start to blend and the lines start to get blurred. And then, you know, I was an open book and I let my family in. And for the longest time, I was okay with that because there was nothing to hide and there was nothing that I wasn't proud of. And then obviously I have my slip ups and I fuck everything up. And now there is something. Now it's like, well, I can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Right. My family is out there and I've fucked this all up, but I gotta keep going.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't then, you know, if I don't keep going, if I don't try to persist, if I puke, cry and go home now, then it's really all for nothing.
Right.
You know, and then it's like, I fucked everything up and I have nothing to show for it.
Right.
And in this case, like I can hopefully try to work on my personal life, but at least I'm going to hopefully have the professional success to justify it in a way, maybe not the right word, but to be like, well, at least, like I said, I think everything comes at a steep cost. And in this case, like a normal family life, I tried to be normal, mm-hmm. and I don't think you can be normal. I think that I always said, I'm going to, you know, get married at the right, regular time. I'm going to have kids when I'm supposed to have them. I'm going to live in the burbs and do that life. And I'm not going to let this job like stop me from doing that. And, I probably should have taken that into account a little more. You know, I probably should have just admitted, not that you can't do it, that would be a cop out, that would be an excuse, but that, you know, let's just address that this life that we are now in is not regular. So
right.
Don't try to just force regularity upon it.
No, I it's gotten hard for me to maintain, to return to a semblance of normalcy. You know, my brain is now constantly thinking of like blogs and things and video ideas and jokes, and I have a hard time on dates or even in conversations just like staying present, and it comes off as arrogance, like detached arrogance, and I think it rubs a lot of people the wrong way, is that they think when they start telling me their story, if I check out, it's because I only want to talk about myself and I'm mm-hmm. not interested in them. And I hate that. I hate that about me. I hate that I am doing that. But the reality is, if I'm not talking about myself, I want to be thinking about ways to keep improving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes any sense. A friend of mine told me about this last night. We had like a heart to heart. A friend of mine was like, I've noticed that over the last year and a half, you check out of conversations if they're not about you.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I was just like, fuck. Like, I hate that about
Yeah,
me.
You don't want to.
Yeah.
But I mean, what it sounds like to me, what you're saying is that it's not coming from a place of, you're not sitting there in your head being like, oh, I don't care.
No.
It's only about me.
Right.
But it's just about trying to like juggle like psychologically, like you have this craft and this passion that you now put on a big stage and it's succeeding and it does become consuming.
Yeah.
And it's not out of like you're a nobody, I don't care about you. But it is out of like, you know, your mind and your heart are racing a million miles a minute
right.
for this thing that you are so passionate about. And it is hard to turn it off.
Yeah. I mean, what ends up happening is like, if I'm in a conversation with somebody, and they say something that all of a sudden triggers my mind towards a joke, mm-hmm. right? They mention something that sends me
fun.
Down this rabbit hole.
Yeah.
To me, jokes are like fish, like on the line. You only have a certain amount of time before my brain loses the hold of them. So what I would ideally do is I would just say, hang on a second. I would take out my phone. I would jot down the premise and then we could move on because then I've got it and I won't forget it again. But that's impolite.
Right.
And I don't like taking my phone out and interrupting someone's train of thought. So what ends up happening is I let them keep talking, but all I'm thinking is like, don't lose this. Don't lose this idea. Don't lose this idea about your dick. Like keep thinking about it. Keep thinking about it. And I miss everything they say. And that's rude. That's even more rude.
Right. Right.
So I've had relationships recently where like this has come up and once I've taught the girl, hey, my jokes, like when I think of jokes, I have to write them down. Then they're okay with it.
Yeah.
But it does, it's a weird phenomenon.
I mean, even just having these conversations, I get worried about when I'm being honest that even this is coming across as like, ah, look at these two fucking like privileged white guys who are talking about how it's so hard for them to like tell their jokes on the internet, you know? It's just about like, to me, like I said, acknowledging it. Like,
yeah.
It's not that normal. So let's not try to act that way.
Right.
Know? I mean, listen, we all personally should work on being, you know, interested in others and not do that. But it is like, you know, again, like a sports analogy, it's like if you're going to be a professional athlete, like from 20 to 35, you're on the road, you're training, you're not going to be, you're going to miss some events. You're going to, you know, if you're in the NBA, you play on Christmas Day every single year.
Yeah. Like
it's to, you know, if you're going to do this right and you are and you've seen what it takes to do it right. Because like you said, there were moments where you're on the edge, like this is not working. So I got to go the extra mile to make it work. It comes at a cost that can be like unfortunate. What's a real hard balance. And the word you used, arrogance is important. I think particularly for yourself, you know, you come from the background of money and Harvard, and that automatically is going to make people be like, all right, wait a minute, fuck this guy. Like I feel like the initial is like, fuck this guy, you have to show me otherwise.
Whereas
most other people get a fair shot, I think you're coming in at a like a negative first, you know?
Yeah, but the flip side is that then I know the positive reactions now are things that I've earned. And I feel like
all the more valuable.
I just feel more validated by the fact that I won the trust of an audience that probably doesn't connect with me that well on a surface level.
Right.
So, and not to like, I think this is an interesting opportunity to clear up some like myths that have
come out about me. Yep.
My family growing up, like we were well off, but we were not, I wouldn't put us in like the uber rich category. My dad started a software company in Maine when I was four. We moved from New Jersey, which is where both my parents are from, and my dad started this software company in Maine. Maine is not exactly a tech hub.
Yeah, not in the Silicon Valley.
It's like fishermen, hunters, and like backwater people. And so it was really not doing well for many years. And my dad tells me stories now about how he would come into my sister's bedroom and my bedroom at night while we were sleeping and look at us and wonder how he was ever going to put us through college.
Wow.
And, you know, it only started succeeding, I guess, around the time that I was in high school. But even then, like, it's his own company. He wasn't taking a lot of money out of it. And we had a family. My parents are both very cultured, sophisticated people. My mom was in the first class of women at Princeton, got her PhD at Yale, was a professor of French at Yale for years. But it's not like she came from a super rich family either. Family of five, grew up in a house, small house in New Jersey. They just were hardworking, smart people. My dad was recruited a lacrosse player. He went to Amherst College. And then my mom went and worked on Wall Street. And like they met later in life when they were 33, 34. Were married very quickly, had my sister, then had me, and then we moved to Maine. And I went to private school from first to eighth grade in Maine, but it was a private school that costs like $8,000 a year.
Private school, you know, plenty of people go to private school.
It's
like, you know, that you have to be uber rich to go to private school.
And then I went to public school for high school, and I was a recruited lacrosse player, and that was the reason I got into Harvard. It was not my dad gave a $250 million donation and they named the library after him. So of course he was going to get in. It was because I was a good student and a good lacrosse player.
Twirl that spoon, baby.
Yeah. And then My dad's company started doing well after college. And
but let me ask you this. I mean, you also put out your pictures from your childhood. You're hanging out with Harrison Ford and shit.
Sure.
Like that.
But I mean,
that's going to give the vibe of affluence.
And absolutely. I totally understand that. But like, let's trace that. Right. So my mom was at Princeton and she was randomly placed to be a roommate with a woman named Lisa Hallaby, who after college, Lisa Hallaby, this beautiful white American woman, joined the Peace Corps. And was stationed in Jordan, where on a trip, she somehow met the king, who was married at the time. He divorces his second wife, marries Lisa Hallaby, renames her Queen Noor.
Holy and shit. Then renames her.
Yeah. What? Noor, which knew of Noor al-Hussein, which means light of Hussein, light of his life. Yeah. And they were married for 25 years. And I mean, it's a massive coincidence, right? Where like, my mom was roommates in college with this woman who like blew up that we had that cool connection to the royal family of Jordan. But those were not regular. There was not a cast of players like that in our lives.
Right.
We grew up in rural Maine, you know, on the water and like, which was nice, but like Maine,
again, I think
isn't that expensive.
A difference between sophistication and wealth, you know,
right.
Like you can be well read and well spoken and live like a certain type of lifestyle that doesn't necessarily mean money.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. Like we were very fortunate growing up. Like I never wanted for really anything. Having said that, again, people know of my family's wealth now. That happened 2 years ago. My dad sold his company in a big sale.
Basically right around when you're starting.
Right around when I started Barstool 2 years ago. And people found the article and then made all these assumptions that like we had grown up with that type of wealth. Not the case at all.
Right.
I mean, again, I would say we were comfortable. I didn't, but I had jobs.
You know,
every summer I was refereeing soccer games. I was working at this kayak rental place on the beach and like, you know, I had a pretty normal childhood, I would say.
I think that it maybe not isn't even the money. It's the lifestyle, like even, you know, the coincidence for sure, but it just, when you hear even just lacrosse and Harvard and you know,
right.
My mom's a PhD and teaches French and like, there's by no means anything wrong with anything.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that there's going to be a lot of people, especially in the Barstool world with this by the common man type of vibe that is like, yeah, well, like my dad is fucking working in construction and my mom.
Sure.
And it's just,
I totally get that. But what the reason I like bring this up is like when I was at Harvard, there were kids on my lacrosse team who had grown up in Greenwich.
Right.
Whose fathers drove Ferraris.
True Silver Spoon type shit, yeah.
And whose parents, whose grandparents had come from banking and had, you know, there was a $400 million nest egg. And it was like, that to me was the type of privilege that I set as the bar for like, holy shit.
Right.
I've never seen wealth like this. Right. These kids grew up never worrying about anything.
Right.
And I didn't think that there was a fucking chance in hell that I would go to Harvard or anything of that nature until my junior year of high school, because I didn't think I would get in academically and I didn't have a clue if I was a decent lacrosse player because I'm from Maine.
Right.
There were no fucking college scouts at any of my high school games.
Right.
We were just kind of up playing in the woods.
Yeah.
And it just turned out that I was like big and fast, which once I got invited to this one camp, these options opened up. And I remember calling my parents that night and being like, you'll never guess who I talked to today. They were like, who? Like D3 coaches, whatever? And I was like, no, the fucking Harvard coach seemed interested. And they were like, what?
Holy shit. Yeah.
And it was just
it's all a tough spot to come from because it does sound like, you know, that conversation was probably a cool one where you're like, you're surprised and your family's shocked and you're proud. But then you just have this image of like the spoiled rich kid. And
yeah.
It's like, that's not really who I am. But you can't also then, like, you can do it now and I'm happy we're doing this because you have, you know, a controlled spot to kind of tell your story. But you try to do that on the blog and on the internet and on radio and you just come across as an asshole.
No one's going to buy it.
It's very tough. And I certainly know it now going through my personal stuff. It's like, once the internet has made up their mind,
yeah,
and there's really no turning it,
right.
And you hope that maybe one day all the details are out or all your story gets out in this setting and they, you know, shift it, but it's almost better to just accept it, roll with it, and as I've heard you do recently, like, make it into a joke.
Yeah, I mean, like, you realize you're never going to win that battle.
Never.
You're never going to teach people...
But people don't realize that. Like, you did, I do. Like, a lot of other people will sit there and fight it and bang their head against the wall, and it's
right.
Like, it is not going to work. You're not going to change their mind.
You can't beat the internet.
Nope.
And
undefeated.
Roy Wood is a great comedian, correspondent on The Daily Show. He's a fantastic comic, very experienced. I was talking to him in the green room of a show before a show not too long ago and talking about internet trolls and how I was really frustrated and I was responding to them. And he goes, listen to me, responding to the people on the internet is like punching the ocean.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to describe it.
It is the most useless. It won't make you feel any better. And then he said, and he gave another analogy. He said, it's like chasing pigeons in the park. You can run after these pigeons and they will scatter and you will think that what you are doing is effective and that you've won because they've run away and scurried into their dark corners. However, all that anyone else sees from afar is a crazy person chasing pigeons in the park.
That's a great point.
And
that's a great way to say it.
It's really true.
I find myself, I think I do get a little bit of, I know I'm not going to win, but I think if I respond every now and then, I get a little peace of mind where it's just like, I've said my piece.
Yeah.
And I know that I, and you know, you try to do it in a calm and rational manner, but I think you can get a little bit of something positive can come out of it. Again, I think that we're kind of writing the script basically, because we're like the only ones doing this, as to how to handle it. Like I said, don't tell me you don't read the comments. You do.
Yeah.
And don't tell me it doesn't affect you. It does. But how does it affect you and how do you respond to it? I think it's okay to address things,
mm-hmm.
or to try to clear things up or to say it now. But yeah, you're right. That's a great imagery of like, look at that asshole chasing those right. pigeons over there. Cause yeah. that's all you look like.
I mean, one thing that gave me peace of mind was I sort of convinced myself that a lot of the vitriol and hate and horrible things that are said sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes in the comment section or wherever else, that the people saying them don't mean it.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not inherently bad people, and that, you know, it's sort of like that Bible passage of like, forgive them, they know not what they do. I don't believe that people are that bad. I think they're just kind of venting, or they are responding as a hope of getting a rise out of somebody because
they know. I mean, and then there's the mob mentality where it's just like, you know, you're saying it cause this guy said it. And
right.
You know, sometimes you realize that you're probably talking to like a 16-year-old kid.
Exactly.
Who's like just fucking around on his computer.
Yeah, he's not a fucking anarchist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like he's not trying to burn our world down.
Yeah.
He's
some
just
of them are, but most of them are not
goofing around. Yeah.
And I found myself, there was a couple times where I've had a tweet written out ready to respond to someone. And then I'm like, they're probably just joking.
Yeah.
I'm going to joke back or
right.
I'm gonna, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, how do I, who I've made a career and a lifestyle off of joking on the internet, how am I missing the joke? How am
right.
I not realizing that they probably don't really care or they're being sarcastic? Like, as long as you can just try to take a step back, and it's hard because it's become our career, it's become our lives. Like I said, you sacrifice a lot for it, but just remember this whole thing is about jokes.
Yeah.
So everything should be a joke.
I agree. I totally agree. And I think we are blanketed and sort of comforted by knowing that we exist in a world of humor where everything should be taken with as satire.
Mm-hmm.
However, when people start to think that you're being serious about stuff and taking what you're saying as a reflection of who you are, I don't understand that.
Yeah, no. It's like, how can you really miss... How can you be so like calibrated incorrectly?
Right.
How are you misjudging this entire situation?
One time, like, I'm not going to remember. I can't remember what I was going to say.
Was it the time that you faked cancer?
No. Well, sure. I mean, let's talk about that. Because, you know, I admit I made a mistake. I made a huge mistake in all of that, which was that I should never have told you mm-hmm. on the radio that day mm-hmm. during that week what had just happened.
Should have just been separate. Kept it quiet.
I shouldn't have said anything because I didn't know yet definitively whether or not I had cancer. I knew that they had found, I was under the impression, I'd been told, they had found cancerous tumors in my throat.
Right.
But that does not medically mean that you have cancer.
Right.
And I think to make that leap and to brand myself as a cancer patient in the middle of the week of Barstool Idol was a horrible mistake. Even if I had had it.
Right.
Even if I had 100% had it, if I was preparing for a chemo treatment, that was not a level of exposure and that and storyline that I was prepared for at that point.
And that and it goes back to how we opened up. Like, you know, I went the route of just telling everybody my life and what was going on. I think you still need to draw a line somewhere. Yeah. I don't even know what my line is because I thought I was never going to really talk about my kids, but then I just ended up posting cute pictures and videos and all of a sudden Podfathers comes about and now even they were in the mix. But yeah, I think like, you know, you got to find your line somewhere.
Right.
And I definitely think that keeping the cancer probably would have been a good line to draw.
Until I'd really figured out what was going on. And I remember I called my parents called my mom from the inside the doctor's office because I didn't understand what the doctor was telling me.
Yeah.
And I put them on the phone together and he explained to her what the deal was.
Right.
And then I spoke to her on the ride home back to the office. Rather, I came straight from the doctor's office back to the office. And I said, how bad is this? And she said, cause my dad has had two runs with prostate cancer and she said, you know, just take it. We're going to take it one day at a time. We need more info. Don't freak out. We'll come down in New York. We're coming down. We'll see you and, we'll figure this out. And that was when the doctor was sending the biopsies for more tests and we were going to do blood tests and all this stuff to figure out if it had metastasized. And I should have taken, we didn't even have the chance to send out an email to the family,
right?
The extended family yet to be like, Francis might found out this news.
Yeah. Right.
I had the chance to tell my sister and my mom and my dad. I didn't tell any of my friends. And then I went straight into the radio room.
Yeah.
And 99% of the people that I'm close to found out
from Barstool
that I had cancer based on a joking conversation I'd had with you on the radio.
Yeah.
And that is a horrible way.
Yeah, I feel
to
bad
deliver
even
that
even
news.
Having been a part
it's
of it.
It's not your fault at all. It's 100% my fault. Personal information of that caliber, of that level and magnitude should not be shared until you either know exactly what the deal is.
Right.
And certainly have the chance to sit the people who matter down and say, here's what's going on.
Deliver it in
it's
a way.
It's about to come out. Yeah. I wanted you guys to know first.
Right.
So then my mom, after I said it on the radio, my mom then hurried out this email to like our extended family being like, I just she wanted pissed. Everyone to know. Not pissed, just like surprised that I had brought it to light. But one of the reasons I did was that I was so shaken by the conversation with the doctor. You know, you hear cancer, you hear cancerous tumor. And I remember like I had gotten a voicemail from the doctor 2 days before saying, you need to come into the office immediately. And when you get that,
never want to hear
you
that.
Know it's bad.
Right.
So like I was preparing myself for the worst. And then when I met with the doctor, he said the words that I did not want to hear. And rather than like process it and have perspective, I just went straight to you, told you what had happened. And I was so shaken from it.
I mean, listen, you're getting bad news and you're currently in the middle of American Idol.
Right. I was on
something
day
that
three.
Nobody's ever done. And you want that so bad. And you're processing over here. It's like you try to compartmentalize, like I said, but there's no compartmentalizing that.
And I have to say, you know, if I'm being totally honest, I was like, I did think, I bet Barstool will be interested in this.
Yeah. It was. And I don't want to say that's why you got it. And by no means, you were for sure the most talented and funny person there. But like, you know, we're in the business of content and interest and intrigue and discussion. And like, It was a storyline.
It was a storyline, and it was something I thought, boy.
That's why I think some people were like,
right. He used it to get the job.
You know, things that like at least seemed inconsistent, or people, you can make anything look that way.
Yeah.
And you think like, I don't know, you know, it's possible.
I agree.
People will do anything these days. And so it just, you know, again, unfortunate coincidences, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's taken me a long time. Like, I used to get so pissed off and upset when people would say that I faked cancer to get a job at Barstool. My immediate response was like, I didn't need to fake cancer to get a job at Barstool. I was good enough.
Yeah.
But the reality is I should not have said anything.
Right. Right.
Because that is true, if I would have gotten the job, then I should have just gotten the job the right way.
Right.
And
you would have.
So I really own the mistake that I made there. And I'm still to this day embarrassed about it. Having said that, I did think in my mind that I had cancer.
Right.
From a doctor's mouth.
Right. I mean,
so there's no faking.
Yeah.
That was the part to me that was
right.
Like,
it's like there's a difference between it ended up not being cancer versus faking.
Yeah.
Versus
I should not have leveraged a cancer diagnosis.
Right. Right. And that's where a lot of people, that's where a lot of the outrage in the beginning was.
And that's fair.
And yeah, because even if you were truly, like you said, if it was 100%, you still shouldn't have brought it up.
Right.
But it was not ever anything you did intentionally.
Yeah.
You know,
right. It's just a lot. It was a lot, you know, for me. And I was young. I mean, I was 3 days in to Barstool. I've learned a lot since then.
Yeah.
You feel like you age in dog years at Barstool.
2 years. It absolutely is.
I feel like I've been working here for a decade.
You always
now.
See the pictures of, you know, Obama coming in and Obama coming out.
Yeah.
It's like the Barstool pictures are going to be similar to that because time is not real when you step into those offices. It's a bizarre.
And then, of course, like one week later. Then I won Barstool Idol. 2 weeks later, I got the call saying we found out that we had mixed up the test results, and I went nuts. The office was nuts. Nate ran to his computer, blogged it, spun the story, defined the narrative. And then another week after that, I had the whole DM
Danielle
thing.
Danielle Harrington walks through the door.
And within...
And again, not helping your, you know, I'm rich, I'm affluent, I'm good looking, I'm successful, and now I'm going to talk to the pretty girls, DM the models.
Right.
And coming from a, you know, by the common man, for the common man, you are now doing all these things that are totally opposite of what every blogger before you had been.
It was such a wild run in the first 3 weeks at Barstool for me, which is why I really thought I was not going to make it. I thought that level of hyper attention to me was how it was going to be. Was that that would persist for the entire time.
Right.
Because it seemed like every week something else was coming out about me that was the story of the week.
So you're like, if it's going to be every single week here, there's no fucking chance.
I wasn't sleeping. Like, Dave's making fun of me. My parents are like calling me being like, hey, what's going on? Are you okay? You're all over Barstool.
Yep.
You're all anyone's talking about. And I was like, I don't think I can do this, you know?
I wouldn't blame you because I don't think anyone could survive that. What I think you learn, and I think a lot of people who are coming into the mix learn, are keep your head down.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, I'm sure you wanted to try to go on a date with Danielle Harrington. It ain't worth that.
Right.
So, you know, you try to stay out of stool scenes. You try to stop getting called into the radio. You just tell your jokes.
Yeah.
Write your blogs. And try to stay off of the Dave Portnoy radar is really what
exactly.
it is.
Exactly. Yeah. And what people... The other thing was... Stool Scenes started the same week that I came in.
Right.
And that was a backstage access to Barstool that nobody had had before.
And I'm a little bit more prepared to tell those stories or present myself in such a way, but you are now the spotlight.
Yeah.
You're the new kid, camera on. You don't know what not to say or what to say or what not to do. So that, again, you now that we told this whole story here, your entire existence here to start was a series of unfortunate coincidences, really.
Yeah.
Timing and perception and misconceptions all coincidentally stacked the deck against you.
But
in a way also
I own
your yes.
Yeah, I mean I own the responsibility, the part that I played in perpetuating and causing some of those events. And I don't blame it on really I could have avoided all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I mean, I'm very glad it was over and it settled down. And then I think over the course of the next year, my work was what defined people's perception of me. But I just, man, it was hard. It was really brutal and miserable for me in the first month at Barstool.
But where you are at now shows the level of talent you have and the level of the thick skin that you have and the mental capacity, the emotional capacity to deal with it. And whether or not we're mentally and emotionally in a perfect spot right now, I think the variety show, your stand-up success, and the way you have won over some people who judged you, the way that you have just grown, is a testament to your ability to handle it all. So
thank you.
And that's where I think you're going to continue to thrive here. And like I said, that gives me hope that, you know, this whole company will continue. Cause if we can find another Francis, even, you know, if American Idol every year was like that, we're fucking golden. Yeah. But even if you find another Francis, you know, every couple years or so, it doesn't be that frequently, we will succeed.
And let's not forget that Donnie also came out of Barstool Idol.
Yeah,
so
right.
It was, you know, he's obviously sensational. And I think that whole project was a success.
So now there's the stand-up career, the variety show, and life after figuring out Barstool, where we can dive into not the backstory and the unfortunate coincidences of Francis, but the content and the work of Francis. And that will be part two of Behind the Blog with Francis Ellis.